RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
My name's Alistair Harding, and this is the latest installment I have for you on the fluoride saga. It just gets clearer and clearer that community water fluoridation is a subject that requires a national conversation here in New Zealand. And today I have the first part of a two-part conversation that I think emphasizes that. This week I spoke to Michael Connett, the lead attorney and also founder of the Fluoride Action Network in the United States. Michael has been on a constant battle against fluoride for much of his life. In fact, his parents, a pair of environmental health researchers, began the family feud with fluoride back in the 1990s. And as a college graduate, Michael himself began fighting it as well in 2000. And so for the last 24 years, if there's been one constant in his life, it is fluoride, or the battle against it, both inside and outside the courtrooms and deposition rooms all over the United States. What I'm trying to get at here is that if there is one person in the world today who's seen every piece of historical, political, scientific, and even anecdotal evidence on the subject of fluoride, this is the man. And in the context of where we are in New Zealand on the subject of fluoride, there is probably no other person on the planet today who can explain better why fluoride shouldn't be in our water. And so the context in New Zealand for this interview is this. Our Parliament passed the Health Fluoridation of Drinking Water Amendment Act in 2021, which took the decision to fluoridate water out of local council hands and gave it to the Director General of Health as a health intervention. And then in 2022, the Director General of Health, at the time Ashley Bloomfield, ordered 14 previously unfluoridated local councils to fluoridate their water. But then, as if on cue, a review of scientific evidence by the National Toxicology Program in the United States came out, showing that there is very real evidence of fluoride affecting children's brains. Which brings us back to Michael Connett, because the only reason we know about that report, and the only reason that today New Zealanders are aware of the neurotoxicity of fluoride, is not because our health officials are researching and providing the information to us, it's because Michael Connett, a lawyer from the United States, went to court and forced the release of the report, which was actually being suppressed by United States government agencies. And so today, to tell us all about that and what it all means to us here in New Zealand, I have the first part of a two-part interview I did with Michael Connett this week. In it, you'll hear him tell us all about his latest legal case that he's won in a federal court in California, in which the judge, reading that NTP report I just mentioned, ruled that fluoride poses an unreasonable risk of IQ loss to children and has ordered the EPA to do something about it. And then tomorrow we'll play the second part of the interview for you, in which we talk about the history of fluoride and how we got to this point where a toxic substance is added to our drinking water supplies in the name of dental health. But also we'll hear how Michael Connett actually believes that fluoride can still play a part in our dental health journey. So, without any more explanation, here's part one of that interview. Michael, welcome to Reality Check Radio.
Thank you, Alistair. It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, so I'd like to start with the context of where we are, and then perhaps we can move our way backwards to give people a full picture of the story of fluoride. So let's start with the recent ruling in your case that came out at the end of September. In that ruling, the judge said that fluoride poses an unreasonable risk to children and told the EPA, that's the Environmental Protection Agency, that they need to take regulatory action to eliminate the risk. Can you tell us about that case and what does that ruling mean? Does it mean the end of fluoride?
It should mean the end of fluoridation, the addition of fluoride chemicals to drinking water. This is a case that I have been litigating now for 7.5 years in a federal court here in the U.S. And as you noted, the court issued its ruling a few weeks ago now, and in the ruling, it's an 80-page, very detailed decision. The court has concluded that adding fluoride chemicals to drinking water poses an unreasonable risk of IQ loss in children. And given that risk, the court has ordered the EPA to take regulatory action to address the risk. So it is a very historic ruling, and one that I think really should raise pretty serious questions for policymakers everywhere about whether, you know, before the EPA takes whatever action it's going to take, I think policymakers really should be asking the question whether a neurotoxicant is something we want to be adding to our drinking water.
Okay, so knowing how fluoride is seen by government health agencies, I expect there is going to be an appeal by the EPA. Is there an appeal coming?
The EPA has not yet made a decision whether to appeal or not. We should know that within a month or two. But if they do appeal, there will be a process where we'll have to go back to court up through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals to address whatever legal issues EPA may raise. But once that is resolved, and assuming the court's decision is affirmed, which I expect it will be, then the EPA must take regulatory action.
There's also a little bit of confusion to some of us here in New Zealand because of the different legal systems. We note that it was a federal court judge who made the decision, but the decision was made in a district court in California. Can you explain that to me? Because it's being framed by some of the pro-fluoride people here in New Zealand that this was a district court decision, therefore it means nothing on a national level. Can you explain that part to me?
Yeah, and that is incorrect. Whoever said that is incorrect. This is a federal court decision. And yes, the federal court is based in California, but the court has authority to order the EPA to take action on a national level. And that is what the court has done. So this is not a decision that only affects part or all of California. This is a decision that affects the entire United States. But any implication that this decision does not apply to the entire United States is simply wrong.
Okay, so just getting this case to court was a real struggle, I understand. It took 7 years to get this ruling. You're 7.5 years into this now. You just mentioned that before. You first brought the case to court in 2016, but then it took 4 years to actually get it to actual trial, and then another 3 to get it to ruling. Can you explain why did it take so long?
Yes, well, this was a slow process, which involved an extensive amount of evidence and expert testimony. The court had the benefit and the opportunity of having a very thorough vetting of the science from distinguished experts on both sides of the issue. So that's part of it. One of the reasons, though, for the delay is we had our first trial in this case in the summer of 2020. And I felt very good at the end of that first trial. I felt the evidence was pretty compelling at that point in time that fluoridation does pose an unreasonable risk. The court, though, wanted to hold off on making a decision at that time because there was, at that point in time, the National Toxicology Program's review, which you mentioned earlier, was currently in draft form, and it was anticipated that the NTP's final report would be out in a matter of months. So the court really wanted to be able to consider NTP's final conclusions. And so the court placed the case on hold. And I understand certainly why the court would want to do that, because the NTP is a very authoritative body on these types of issues, and the court wanted that input from this federal agency. And so we waited and waited, and it turned out that it took much longer than anticipated for the NTP to issue its final report. And what happened is in 2022, so about 2 years after the court placed the case on hold, I got a tip-off from somebody who had knowledge about what was going on with the NTP. And this source, who wanted to remain anonymous, told me that the NTP had actually completed its report and that it had been prevented from publishing it due to concerns about the implications of the report to water fluoridation. So when I heard that, I was very concerned because this court case is being held up for the release of NTP's report. So if NTP's report is never going to be published because of political considerations, then we're never going to resume the court case. So I immediately went to the court. I explained what was going on. And the court agreed that we could no longer continue waiting for NTP to finalize the report. And so the court set the case for a second trial. And at that second trial, we were able to consider a draft version of the NTP report. And this draft was dated May of 2022. And that was a draft that the NTP itself considered to be final. The NTP actually, on May 11th, 2022, announced to the other federal agencies that this report was going to be published in 7 days on May 18th, 2022. It was all set. They had gone through multiple rounds of peer review, and NTP's leadership signed off on this report as the final assessment of the agency. And then the politics came in, and the NTP was blocked from publishing it. So we were able, thankfully, through discovery, to get a copy of that report. And the experts at the second trial, which occurred earlier this year, were able to discuss the findings and the implications of NTP's findings to water fluoridation.
And this is what I was referring to at the top, right? That you've actually forced this NTP report out into the public. And if it wasn't for your court case, it wasn't actually going to be released, right? So who was suppressing it?
It was the political leadership in the Department of Health and Human Services of the U.S. government. And we obtained, Alistair, a large number of emails from various factions of Health and Human Services discussing the NTP report. And these emails show very clearly that it was the CDC Oral Health Division, as well as this institute called the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research, and these are the two sort of federal bodies that are very actively involved in promoting water fluoridation. They're not neutral sort of umpires on the science of fluoride. They're very active partisans in the fluoridation debate. And they were the two main bodies really pushing behind the scenes to block NTP from publishing its findings. And they went up the ladder to the person in charge of the Public Health Service, which is the big umbrella federal organization that includes CDC and the National Institutes of Health. And that was the Assistant Secretary of Health. And she ultimately, at the request of CDC and the National Institute of Dental and Craniofacial Research, she ultimately ordered the NTP to not publish its findings. So it's really the bodies promoting fluoridation in the federal government were able to block the report.
I mean, to me, that's absolutely astounding. Is it surprising to you that government agencies would behave like this? I mean, I always think that generally these people are representing the public's interests, yet they're suppressing data on the toxicity of a product that they're putting in our water supply.
I almost wish I could say I was surprised, but I wasn't, because there is a long-standing track record on the fluoride issue where the federal government in the United States has suppressed data adverse to the fluoridation program. So there's a long-standing history of that, where the federal government has seen its role as promoting fluoridation, not being the sort of independent umpire on the science to tell us the good facts and the bad facts. And that's been a real disservice, I think, to the public. You know, I think we, the public, count on our health officials to tell us the facts, good and bad. Because if we don't have the good facts and the bad facts, we can't make an informed decision. And for too long, the bad facts about fluoride have been airbrushed away because at the end of the day, health officials, they don't trust the public to make the right decisions with the full palette of information. So they keep the full spectrum of information away from us.
You know, we get preached to a lot these days by the media and politicians about the need to protect democracy and protect against misinformation and all of those sort of soundbite things. Yet I see this case as a real example of those things, that this has been a case of disinformation, an example of information being suppressed by government officials. And that's the real attack on democracy, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a big believer in the free flow of information. Give people the full spectrum of information. You know, I trust that if with good information in, you get good results out. But you have to trust and respect people enough to give them all of the information and not to curate it to only include the information that supports your side or the information that supports fluoridation. And again, I think that's really how federal health officials, that's how they've seen their job, is to tell people the good things about fluoride and minimize the stuff that is concerning.
I've also seen this happen in New Zealand. I made a film, Fluoride on the Brain, for Reality Check Radio, all about this topic and our New Zealand context. And as I was researching it, that's actually something that I noticed in our New Zealand Chief Science Advisor's report on fluoride, that it read very much like a piece of promotional material for fluoride. And, you know, I challenge anybody to take a look and make up their own mind on that one, but that was my impression. Why is it being so strongly promoted? What's their interest in this?
It's a great question, and I wish I had better answers than I do, frankly, because I am surprised today, Alistair, that you still see so much effort to promote fluoridation. I'm surprised for a number of reasons. One, we now know that fluoride's predominant benefit, whatever it is, to the teeth comes from topical contact with the teeth. You don't need to swallow it, right? So if you don't need to swallow it, why are we still adding it to drinking water? That's something that, you know, I would have thought we would have ended fluoridation based on that discovery alone, right? We also know that the countries, like in the vast majority of Europe, that do not add fluoride to their water, their cavity rates are just as low and often lower than in highly fluoridated countries like the United States and New Zealand. So we know that you don't actually need fluoridation programs to have low cavity rates, right? So why do we insist on continuing to fluoridate? And then we know, as the court's decision highlights, that there are some serious health risks from ingesting fluoride. And of course, you will ingest fluoride if you add it to your water supply. We have health risks like effects on the brain, effects on the thyroid, effects on bones, including bone fracture and arthritis. So you have all these health risks that are completely unnecessary. They're unnecessary because you don't need to swallow fluoride. So why are we continuing with a program that poses unnecessary risks? Why are we doing it? That's a good question. So I think first off is you have a great amount of institutional inertia that has developed over time. You have these organizations, government organizations, and dental trade organizations that have aggressively promoted fluoridation for many decades. And they've promoted it in very absolute terms as being completely safe and very effective. And I think it's hard for them to change that tune, right? It's hard to say like, oops, we were wrong. And actually, it's not really effective and it's causing some significant harm. And I'm happy to talk about other factors, but that's certainly one that I think helps to explain why we are in the situation we are in.
Okay, so let's get back to your trial for a few moments. I want to talk to you about something that was a big part of the trial and a big part that's weighing on my mind, and that's the discussion around pregnancy and babies, both born and unborn, and the effects of fluoride on them. this is a subject that many of us, I think, might wince at, in that if there's a problem for unborn children and babies, these are the most vulnerable members of our society, and I'd hate to think that our health authorities are playing with their well-being. So can you spell it out for me? Why was there a big focus on pregnancy and babies?
Well, because it was accepted by the experts on both sides that there is a heightened vulnerability during pregnancy and early infancy to the effects of chemicals that can affect the brain, okay? And there's a couple of reasons for that. The first is that, you know, as adults, we have a well-formed blood-brain barriers. And the blood-brain barrier keeps chemicals out of the brain, or does so to a large degree, right? But when the baby's in the womb, and even for the first 6 months of infancy, the blood-brain barrier is not yet fully formed. And so chemicals that get into the body have ready access to the brain. So that's the first reason why there's a concern about early life exposures to a neurotoxicant like fluoride. Second reason for concern is that during the prenatal period and early infancy, the brain is undergoing rapid development. And it is well understood that is a period when the brain is vulnerable to, you know, suffering permanent disruptions or permanent harm from exposures to a chemical when it's undergoing this rapid development. And so that's another reason why there's a concern about exposing the baby in the womb and in early infancy to neurotoxicants like fluoride. And we have, you know, in North America, there have been, as I mentioned, birth cohort studies which have measured fluoride in the urine of pregnant moms in Canada and Mexico and have found that the fluoride levels during pregnancy predict IQ scores in childhood. The more fluoride the mother has in her body during pregnancy is significantly correlated to IQ deficits in children at ages 3, 4, 6, and 12. So there's actual data. Not only was there a sort of these biological reasons to be concerned about exposing the baby to a neurotoxicant like fluoride, but we actually have human epidemiological studies that have found that prenatal exposure to fluoride specifically is associated with IQ loss.
Okay, so I suppose my only question is, how do you excuse that? Is there perhaps some sort of benefit that can be pointed to?
Well, that's a great question, because in this case, I had the opportunity to depose a representative of the CDC. The representative was Casey Hannon, who's the director of CDC's Oral Health Division. And the CDC representative testified under oath that there are no benefits that CDC is aware of prenatal fluoride exposure or early infant fluoride exposure on the teeth. No benefits. And I think that's a really important point that people should be aware of, is at this moment in time when the child is most vulnerable to the neurological effects of fluoride in the womb and in early infancy, that is a period of time where there is no benefit of fluoride on the teeth. It's all risk and no benefit during this important and vulnerable period of life. And I think that's something that I hope policymakers will become aware of and really consider and appreciate. I mean, the public water supply, I think we all should agree, should be safe for the pregnant mom, right? I think the public water supply should be safe for a family that has a newborn infant and the mother can't breastfeed, right? You should be able to mix the formula with your tap water. It should be safe for the baby. And so I think this is a point that I think is not well understood yet, but really should be.
Okay, I just want to step back just one step. We're talking about the National Toxicology Program, in this particular review of all of the literature on these problems we're talking about. Could you please just put into context for our New Zealand audience, who is the NTP, where do they sit, and what's the credibility of this research? Because that has been called into question by some pro-fluoride people in New Zealand, and I'd just really like to hear what that case is.
Right. The National Toxicology Program is part of the National Institutes of Health, which is seated within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services in the U.S. government. And Alistair, at trial in this case, EPA's experts readily acknowledged and agreed that the NTP is a highly esteemed expert body on the issue of chemical hazards. Okay. And also, Alistair, at trial, EPA's experts agreed that NTP's systematic review on fluoride is a high quality review that followed all of the rules of systematic review. So there was no dispute that we are dealing here with a high quality scientific analysis. So for anyone saying that the NTP report is not reliable or credible, just know that EPA's experts, who had every reason to agree with that and every reason to advance that point in front of a court, did not do so. And in fact, agreed with us that NTP's report is a high quality report that warrants substantial weight in any review on this issue.
There's another argument that I hear also against the NTP report and the judge's decision in your case, and that's that here in New Zealand, they tell us that we have fluoride at such a low level in our water that there is no danger.
So in New Zealand, it's my understanding that you still fluoridate water at between 0.7 and even as up to one part per million, with I think an average at around 0.85 parts per million. Well, to put that in perspective, the court in our lawsuit, in the United States, we fluoridate water at 0.7 ppm, so a little bit less than New Zealand. So the court was focused on 0.7 parts per million, and the court specifically concluded that 0.7 parts per million, quote, poses an unreasonable risk of reduced IQ in children, unquote. That's 0.7 parts per million. So if 0.7 parts per million poses an unreasonable risk, then obviously 0.85 parts per million also poses a risk.
Okay, so another point that keeps getting made here in New Zealand is that they keep saying there's no evidence. This is what we're told, that there's no evidence that fluoride causes any damage to any of us. I feel like this is becoming a harder argument to make now that we have this 1,500-page National Toxicology Program scientific review.
Well, and you know what? Here's a point for you, Alistair. You ready? It is frequently said by advocates of fluoridation that there are thousands of studies that prove that fluoridation is safe. Sometimes the more enthusiastic advocates of fluoridation will even up the ante and say, there's over 30,000 studies that prove that fluoridation is safe. Well, in this case, I had the luxury of getting sworn testimony under oath, okay? And getting people to have to put up or shut up and say it under oath under penalty of perjury, okay? As an attorney, that's one of the luxuries we have, right? So I went to the FDA, the CDC, the EPA, the three companies that sell fluoridation chemicals in the United States, and this other institution called the NSF, which is the private body that regulates water treatment chemicals in the United States. I went to each and every one of those organizations, and I asked them, not for 30,000 studies, not for thousands of studies, I asked them for one study that they could point to establish that fluoridation is safe for the brain, that early life exposures to fluoride is safe for the brain. One study, and not a single one of those organizations could point me to any study that shows that fluoridation is safe for the brain. So it was very interesting to see how quickly 30,000 studies went to zero studies when you ask someone under oath, under penalty of perjury, to actually provide the documentation.
There's another part to this too. I also noticed a rather compelling video that you've circulated on social media, and it's from one of your depositions for the EPA case. And that's a woman from one of those health agencies. Sorry, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, but she was telling you that the NTP report should actually make countries around the world reconsider their fluoridation plans. Could you jog my memory a little bit on that one and also to explain about it to our audience for us?
Yes, this was a deposition that I took of Joyce Donahue, who is a senior scientist in EPA's Office of Water. And Dr. Donahue has been EPA's subject matter expert on fluoride since the 1990s. She's been very involved on fluoride issues at the EPA. And I asked Dr. Donahue for her assessment of these recent NIH-funded birth cohort studies on fluoride and IQ. As you may know, the NIH has funded these studies in Mexico and Canada, and they have found significant associations between prenatal fluoride exposure and IQ reductions in children. And Dr. Donahue agreed that these are very well done studies, that their findings are very important. And in her view, they do warrant a reassessment of all fluoride safety standards, not just in the United States, but everywhere. And that was EPA's own scientist who said that.
Okay, now we've also got another review that's come out. If we're talking about proof and scientific studies and so on, this one's done by the Cochrane Collaboration, saying that fluoride may have been useful in preventing tooth decay back in the 1970s, and I believe they're talking about studies from the United Kingdom in this one, but that over time, as people started using fluoride-laced toothpaste more and more, it's now become basically useless in water. Can you comment on that? And also, I get the feeling that this is them backing out of the problem by not having to admit the neurotoxicity. It did do some good in the water, but now we've got it in the toothpaste. You know, we don't necessarily need to do it in the water anymore. And that way they don't have to confront the issue of neurotoxicity.
Well, first, I am certainly familiar with this systematic review from the Cochrane Center in the UK. And the Cochrane Center is well regarded as providing sort of the gold standard systematic reviews on the efficacy of medical treatments. So this is a very well regarded research group. And in this systematic review, they looked at studies from around the world. And they concluded, as you said, that the benefits of water fluoridation are much smaller than were previously claimed to be the case. And in fact, they concluded that the benefits from water fluoridation may be zero. There may not actually be a benefit from water fluoridation based on what the data now says. But I think their findings also highlight that in an age where you now have so many fluoride products readily available, and not expensive. I mean, you go to the grocery store and look at a tube of fluoride toothpaste. This is not an expensive product. So it's widely available. Anyone can get it. You don't need a prescription for fluoride toothpaste. In this era with so many fluoride products, there's just no need to be adding it to your drinking water anymore. And when you add it to your drinking water, you're creating an overexposure problem because we're getting fluoride from non-water sources and water sources. And so, you know, I think for someone who's promoted fluoridation for a long time, the Cochrane Review, you know, certainly provides, I think, a soft landing, if you will, like, hey, it's just not as effective as we once thought. And let's leave it at that and like move on to bigger and better things. Like, let's stop this fluoridation program. I mean, the Cochrane findings by themselves are sufficient to end this program. And when you look at them together with the data on health effects, then it's an even more compelling argument to end this program.
So is this the end of fluoride in our drinking water, do you think?
It certainly should be. And, you know, scientific paradigms die hard. Medical orthodoxies can last a long time, right? So it is going to take vigilance for, you know, people raising these issues with government leaders and policymakers so that the data can't be ignored. You know, it's really been left to citizens to keep this issue in the spotlight. Because if it weren't for citizens raising concerns and asking questions, you know, government leaders would have been very content to just bury this forever and not talk about it. So I suspect that will continue to be the case, that people will still have to keep raising this issue. But we're seeing a lot more scientists prepared to discuss the hazards of fluoride and investigate and publish their finding. Right? And you see that with the National Toxicology Program coming out and publishing its findings. It's becoming a safer issue to discuss. And so I do think the days of water fluoridation are numbered. I think it's really a question of when, as opposed to if it's going to end. And hopefully it's going to end sooner than later, because this is a program that is posing unnecessary risks to millions of people's health. We simply do not need it in our water. And once we get it out of our water, I think public health will improve significantly.
That's Michael Connett with the first part of our two-part interview with him. And if you missed his introduction at the beginning, Michael Connett is the lead attorney in the recent court case in the United States where a federal court judge ruled that fluoride poses an unreasonable risk of IQ loss to children and ordered the EPA to do something about it, which perhaps means the end of community water fluoridation for good. Michael's story is partly exhilarating and partly horrifying. It's exhilarating because it's the story of David versus Goliath, a lawyer and his team in the traditions of Aaron Brockovich, who's gone up against the power of multiple US government departments who sought to stonewall and silence a bombshell national toxicology report that confirmed that the so-called conspiracy theorists and flat earthers were right all along, that fluoride does damage children's brains. And he won. And now we all know the truth, and surely now it's only a matter of time before sanity prevails and we do away with fluoride in our drinking water for good. But it's also horrifying as well that government officials could put lobbyists and their own pride, not wanting to be wrong, ahead of our most vulnerable, our children, and their brains. And that story is still not over. Tomorrow, join me for part two of the interview when I talk to Michael about the history of fluoride. What is fluoride? And what do the government documents and paper trails that he's uncovered in his almost quarter century battle tell us about how it ended up in our water? But also how, surprisingly, Michael Connett still thinks fluoride can play a part in our dental health journey into the future. And lastly, if you want to know more about the New Zealand context of the fluoride story, please go to www.realitycheck.radio, where you'll find our RCR original documentary, Fluoride on the Brain. My name is Alistair Harding, and I'll be back tomorrow with part two of our interview with Michael Connett, right here, only on Reality Check Radio.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.